The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with, even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is Sunday, the 31st of May, 2015, and I'd like to give a special welcome to our guests. Thank you for coming and joining us this morning. And I'd like to start with a quote from a book called Ruling Your World, Ancient Strategies for Modern Life. And it's a quote within the book. The book is written by Sakyong Mipham, a Tibetan Buddhist monk and teacher. And he speaks of an ancient Himalayan king called Dawa Sangpo, the first king of the ancient Himalayan kingdom of Shambhala, once supplicated the Buddha for spiritual guidance. He said, "I'm a king. I have a palace, a family, ministers, subjects, an army, and a treasury. I want to realize enlightenment, but I cannot abandon my responsibilities to pursue spiritual practice in a monastery. Please teach me how to use life in the world to become enlightened." The Buddha assured the king that he would not have to become an ascetic or a monk in order to attain enlightenment. Indeed, he could practice the spiritual path while fulfilling his many responsibilities. He could become a Sakyong, a ruler who rules by balancing heaven and earth. Heaven is wisdom, earth is nitty-gritty experience. When we begin to mix wisdom into our secular life, we have success, both spiritual and worldly. The Buddha said to the king, "Don't be biased. Look at the land and look at your people. If you can develop certainty in the indestructible basic goodness that lies at the heart of everything, then you can rule your world. But becoming a Sakyong is a challenging path, since life in the world is full of decisions to make as well as endless distractions." Taking these instructions to heart, King Dawa Sangpo developed certainty in the view of basic goodness, and this vision transformed his kingdom, for it brought inspiration and meaning to people's lives. In America today, Buddhism is once again transformed as it becomes more and more widely known in America, more and more practiced in America, and as with Buddhism entering in the various different countries it took root in after India, where it began, it changed, influenced by the culture of the country. And while traditionally Buddhism has mainly been practiced by monks and nuns, with, of course, what we call supporting bodhisattvas, supporting those monks and nuns, in America, many, many, many people in daily life choose to do Zen practice. And they don't need to be ordained as a monk or a nun, as you already heard. And in fact, the lay path is actually more challenging and can bring you deeper than being an ordained practitioner. Most of the ordained practitioners live in monasteries, and the schedule is developed in such a way that it enhances a person's ability to practice. There's a lot of times, a lot of hours of practice, of official practice, of formal practice, and the day is streamlined in terms of responsibilities so that you can just concentrate on your practice mainly. At Sogenji, where Sosui Sensei and I have both trained, it's a kind of an integrated practice because the monks and the nuns and the lay people who are practicing there, all of whom are called monks, whether they're ordained or not, keep the same schedule. And part of that schedule involves being what's called tenzo, or the cook, head cook for the day. And the responsibilities of the tenzo begin with the very early morning sitting and chanting and continue on as the rest of the practitioners go down to the zendo to do zazen, then the head cook goes first to set up the waiting area for sanzen, a private instruction with a teacher, and then is first to sanzen, so they have to have kept their practice going, and because they're first to meet the teacher, who of course will demand an expression of the most deep level of practice from them. And then they go right away to the kitchen to start breakfast. During the day, and the day is a long one, it doesn't end till about 9 o'clock at night, they answer the telephone, they answer the front door, and they deal with people coming and going, as well as getting all the meals on the table, on time, and cleaning up the kitchen after each meal. In particular, doing a thorough cleaning of the kitchen, including swabbing down the floor after the end of the evening meal. And then there is tea with the Roshi, and then Zazen, except that they stay in the kitchen area to answer the telephone again. But again, they are the first to Sanzen that evening after having set up for Sanzen. And eventually they then join the group again at the end of the evening. So they're having to keep their practice going in the midst of activity. And this is what we ask of any person who's doing Zen practice. And it's a particular opportunity for lay people because you've got your day full of activities, both required activities and optional activities, and you're having to travel on the freeways to and from work, having to think of the daily food preparation for the household, daily responsibilities, balancing checkbooks, and interacting with friends and neighbors and family, taking care of birthdays and all kinds of special things like that, which people in a monastery, although we do celebrate birthdays at Sogenji, much to the bemusement of the Roshi, because birthdays aren't normally celebrated, particularly in Japan. There's a lot of responsibilities for lay people that don't exist for monks and nuns or people training in a monastery. And what that means for lay people is that you've got to be extra careful, to be especially aware. We're all called upon to be especially aware, whether we're ordained or not, because profound awareness is what brings us to awakening. Profound awareness is what frees us from our habit patterns of greed, anger, and delusion. It makes life very different for us. Profound awareness is what helps us to, actually it underscores and provides the basis for a deep, enriching life. We work in the Zendo, in our meditation, as concentratedly as possible to develop that awareness, to bring it to sharp focus. Unfortunately, in America these days, people are, in general, not very focused and not very aware. We have so many distractions. And you've seen all the stuff on the web about vehicle accidents where people are texting while they're driving, or silly little videos showing people walking off docks while they're texting because they're not paying attention to where they're walking, suddenly finding themselves plunged into the water, or otherwise reaping the karmic rewards of distraction. And we have a lot of electronic toys to play with. We have a lot of distractions. We have a lot of stuff going on. Just to drive down one of these California freeways is distracting enough. You've got people cutting across you, just about taking out your fenders. You've got people passing on the shoulder. You've got people suddenly stopping ahead of you. You've got people tailgating you so that if you have to stop, they're going to run right into you. There's a lot of stuff going on just traveling the freeways in this state, or pretty much anywhere. Although I have to say that in New Mexico, our freeways are not quite as challenging as they are in California. We've got television. Television, the amount of time given to actual programming on television is minuscule compared to the ads. And unless you're able to get some kind of cable program where you can delete the ads or at least get some major program time between ads, you're being flashed out and enticed into so many different things just in the process of trying to sit down and relax after dinner. When we come to the Zendo, we bring a lot of that stuff in with us. And it's a challenge to do the practice. We have this incredible Sesokan practice here, practice of extending the out-breath, where we simply breathe out, trying to focus completely on the physical experience of breathing out. And then when we reach a point where we've breathed out as far as we think we're going to breathe out, then we take it a little bit further, because that forces us to focus. It forces us in focusing to let go enough of the other stuff that we can focus. And that is an incredible gift. And we practice it again and again. And gradually we become able to drop some of the yada, yada, yada that goes on in the backgrounds of our mind. We become more able to focus so completely on the moment that we can enjoy its richness, no matter what it brings to us. This is the benefit of practice. And the more we do it, the greater the benefits and the deeper the benefits. And if we take it far enough, there is something called Kensho, which means seeing into. And the seeing into is into the true nature of reality. And that provides a tremendous amount of freedom. Not license, but freedom from our stuff. Freedom to truly be who we really are. Freedom to drop beneath the self-image that we've developed willy-nilly since we were born. Freedom from that self-image that drives our reactions to things and determines how we perceive things, distorts our vision. The more we do this practice, the clearer our vision becomes until we are able truly to see. And in that seeing, there is tremendous freedom. There is this story. It's not a story, it's actually a true event that happened in 1600s. This is in the 1600s in Japan. And some of you already know. It's a story of a Zen master named Shido Munan, whose name literally means the great way is not difficult, which is the beginning of a long teaching poem that was written by the third patriarch of China. The great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose. So Shido Munan had done a lot of zazen, seated meditation. He'd done a lot of meditation practice. And he had come to awakening. He'd had a number of those Kensho experiences deeply enough that when he was middle-aged and a young unmarried girl in the village that he was at the temple at got pregnant. And her parents wanted to know who the father was. And first she would not tell. And finally, she blurted out, "It's that priest, Shido Munan," which horrified the parents. It horrified the village, actually, because in those days, Japanese priests and monks were celibate. And indeed, Shido Munan was celibate, and he was not the father of this child. Nonetheless, the mother said that's who he was, so who's to doubt that? And when the baby was born, the grandparents marched it over to the temple and presented it to Shido Munan. In a combination of anger, grief, and mortal embarrassment, because in Japan of the era, and even Japan in modern times, that sort of thing would be far more embarrassing and far more detrimental to the image of the family than we can even conceive of in America. In America, young girl gets pregnant, says who the father is. These days, it's not a big deal. In the 1950s, it was a little bit more of a big deal, but now it's not particularly. Many, many women are having babies without being married, and or in relationships where they're coupled up but not being married, and there are all different kinds of relationships where babies are born into and accepted. But in Japan in the 16th century, this was anathema. So they bring this infant to the monk, and what's his reaction? There's an expression in Japanese, soka, which is almost impossible to translate into English because it's a very humble way of saying something like, oh, it seems like this, doesn't it? That's all he said. He didn't say, hey, you got the wrong guy here. What do you mean I wouldn't do such a thing? I'm a celibate monk. How can you imagine that I would do such a thing? She must be lying. None of that. Just, oh, it does seem like that, doesn't it? And he received the child, and the whole village scorned him for the next year. He had a very difficult time getting anything to eat, much less feeding this infant. And here he is, a middle-aged monk who hasn't really got any experience raising infants. And this is an era well before disposable diapers and formula and all the rest of it. But he carried that baby around on his back as he went about his cleaning and gardening and the rest of what he did during his day. And he raised that child for a year. And after a year, the mother confessed who the father really was. And now the parents, the grandparents, are deeply embarrassed again, because here they have disparaged this monk, caused all kinds of problems for a whole year to him, because their daughter had lied. And so they went back, heads hung low, begged his forgiveness, and asked for the baby back. And again, all he said was, oh, seems like this, doesn't it? He felt no need to say, you should have known it couldn't have been me. No need to say, what do you think I've been through for the whole year? None of that. He was totally free. And we know this story because the villagers were so impressed by that response, by those two responses, that they carried that tale down to today. We can all be that free. Can you imagine a moment when you've been accused of something you didn't do and it has severe ramifications? Or when somebody's been seriously angry at you? How does it feel? Do you feel like you need to defend? Do you feel like you need to make excuses? Do you feel like you need to say, hey? Or can you just say, oh, it seems like this, doesn't it? Doing the practice deeply enough for a long enough time will bring us there. However, in the process, you're going to open to all the places where you are caught. And that's not really fun. If I had a penny for every time I'd winced at something I recalled in my mind more clearly than I had before, I would probably be a millionaire today. And I can also say it is so worth it to look squarely at it, not to try to turn and deny behavior. Of course, part of the problem is we're not aware of it a lot of the times, but the practice will bring clarity to our minds and we'll begin to be able to see more accurately how we've behaved. And whether we're ordained or not, whether we have a busy lay life or live in a monastery, if we take that and run with it and really work, that freedom will come. I promise you, there is no doubt. I've seen many, many people open to increasing liberation in their lives as a result of this practice. And I know the potential is there for everyone. And in a way, it starts with seeing the fundamental goodness in people and in things. After all, the Buddha said, wonder of wonders, all beings are perfect, whole and complete, just as they are. But because their minds are turned upside down through delusive thinking, through conditioning, they fail to perceive it. And so they act in ways that deny it. But that perfect core is there within every one of us. Even the worst people. And it can be accessed. There was a man named Frankie Parker, some of you may have heard of. He was raised in a very painful way, a lot of abuse. And as an adult, he murdered a woman, and he thought he murdered her 11-year-old daughter. But the daughter ended up surviving after all, and he was found and sentenced to death. And he was an incorrigible prisoner initially. He spent a lot of time in solitary confinement because of his behavior. And one day a guard, for whatever reason, tossed into his solitary cell a copy of the Dhammapada, which is the earliest teachings of the Buddha. And in there is a pair of linked verses. It's a whole chapter of linked verses, but in particular, this one set of linked verses. You are what you think, having become what you thought. And I may have these reversed, but anyway, bear with me. Like the cart that follows the cart-pulling ox, evil follows an evil thought. We are what we think, having become what we thought, like the shadow that never leaves us. Good follows a good thought. And he read that, and something clicked for him. And he turned his life around. He started actually practicing Zen and became a model prisoner. And not just a model prisoner, but he was able to help ramp down the anger and the rage of other prisoners. And other prisoners began doing zazen and calming down as a result of him. Eventually he was put to death. And the remaining family of the mother of the woman he had murdered were present to watch him die. And last thing he did was to turn and face them and say, I'm sorry. Transformation is possible. Incredible transformation is possible. And if he could do that with the life that he led, then certainly we who have led far more amiable lives can do it as well. The practice is here. All we have to do is do it. That's the big challenge. But it's guaranteed to work. Thank you for listening, and we'll stop now and recite the four vows.